Our thoughts are not to be determined by the thought patterns of the world in which we live. How then do we begin to think and act like Christians? Do we simply think more Christian thoughts? Is there a formula? Welcome to the Bible Study Hour, a radio and internet broadcast with Dr. James Boyce, preparing you to think and act biblically. Christians have struggled down through the ages with the renewing of the mind, since the world has never been supportive of the Christian mindset. And yet there is nothing, however trivial or worldly, that cannot be pondered through a Christian lens. But there is a premise from which we must begin. Join Dr. Boyce now as he examines the source of Christian thinking, the doctrine of God, as the specific answer to secular thought.
In the last two studies, as we've been trying to see what it means to think in a Christian way rather than in a worldly way, I mentioned the name of Harry Blamires. Harry Blamires is an Englishman. He studied with C.S. Lewis, and he's written two very good books on this subject. The first one is called The Christian Mind, How Should a Christian Think? And the second is Recovering the Christian Mind, Meeting the Challenge of Secularism. The first was published in 1963, and the second in 1988. In each of these books, Blamires encourages us to stop thinking the way the world thinks, but to begin to think Christianly. Now, that is exactly what Paul is talking about in Romans 12:2. This is our text, and it's where Paul says, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." And that means that our thinking is not to be determined by the thought patterns of the culture in which we live, whatever that thought culture may be. Rather, that we are to have a distinctly different and growing Christian world and life view. But that leads to the question, what does it actually mean to have an outlook like that? Or to put it in slightly different terms, how do we experience what I've called mind renewal in our exceedingly mindless age? Now, the one thing this does not mean is what I think most people probably assume it does mean, and that is to start thinking more about Christian things. We have to do that, of course. We do have to think about Christian things because it's on the basis of the things that have been revealed in Scripture, which are Christian things, that we have a basis and a system of thought that enables us to think about other things as well. If we don't have the revelation, we certainly are not going to think in a Christian way. But that's not what we mean when we talk about developing a Christian mind. What we're talking about here is thinking in a Christian way about everything. And that can include very mundane things as well. The proof of it, of course, is that it is possible to think in a very secular way, even about spiritual things. It's possible to think in a very secular way about the communion service. Now, most Christians would say that's about the most spiritual moment of their lives. When in the company of God's people, having heard the exposition of the word, they partake of the elements that represent the very heart of our profession, that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, suffered a broken body and shed his blood for our sin, that we might be saved. But you can be sitting there and you can think quite secularly, even when you're thinking about the communion service. You might be a trustee of the church, for example. You might be saying, well, it's about budget time, and oh, I forgot to put in the budget the necessary money to buy the communion elements. That was an oversight on my part, and I have to deal with that next week. Or you might be sitting there critically. You might be watching the minister as he officiates and saying, you know, he's very awkward when he does that. I've been in other places where the man did that with so much more polish. I wish somebody would draw our minister aside and tell him how to do it well. Or you may be thinking positively. Suppose you're sitting there thinking, you know, observing communion is really a good thing, these religious practices, and it's a good thing that Christian people do that. I'm sure it's good for them. It gives them a good feeling about themselves, and they get a few moments where they can sit and meditate, and it's always good for us to do that in this fast-paced life, and well, it's good to have churches that do that sort of thing in our society. Now, in each of those three cases, though in quite different ways, the people involved are thinking secularly. On the other hand, It's possible to think in a Christian way about very mundane things. Harry Blaymeyers, in the book I mentioned, suggests you can do that when you pull up at a gas station, getting your car filled up with gas, a very mundane thing. But he said, look, you can think this way. You could be reflecting, for example, on how a mechanized world like ours with cars and other machines tends to make God seem unnecessary. Most people, you see, in a past age where people were more exposed to the elements, you'd pray for good weather and got good weather. You thought God gave that to you, but you don't have to worry about that now. You just drive in your car, you have windshield wipers and that sort of thing. You might be thinking along those lines. You might be reflecting how our cars, which enable us to get from place to place quickly, speed up the pace of our lives and therefore somewhat exclude time for reflection on God or anything else of lasting value. You might be thinking of advertisements for automobiles and how they encourage us to covet a bigger and a better one, and so we end up breaking the 10th commandment because of our cars. Or you might be thinking, what do cars and gasoline and digging for oil and all of that transportation of oil, what does that have to say with the environment? We're made stewards of the environment by God, and we have a responsibility there. You see, it's not a question of what answers you come up with in that type of reflection, but that is thinking Christianly about something that's very mundane. Harry Blaymeyers says, there's nothing in our experience, however trivial, worldly, or even evil, which cannot be thought about Christianly. There is likewise nothing in our experience, however sacred, which cannot be thought about secularly. Considered, that is to say, simply in its relationship to the passing existence of bodies and psyches in a time-locked universe. So I come back to where we were a moment ago, and I ask, where do we start? How do we begin to think and therefore also to act like Christians? Now, there's a sense in which you can begin anywhere. If truth is a whole, well, then you can plunge in at any point. I sometimes say if you begin with Genesis 1:1, you end up at the very last verse of Revelation. You can start at the last verse of Revelation, work your way back to Genesis 1, truth is a whole. So you could really approach it that way, but I suppose that there's probably no better place or more necessary place to start than with the doctrine of God. Because after all, the doctrine of God is the specific Christian answer to secularism. We have to say, if God exists, what does that mean? How should that affect our thinking? Well, one thing it ought to mean is this. It means that there is such a thing as the supernatural. Now, when I use the word supernatural, I'm using it in the most literal sense. Supernatural, that is above, over, in addition to, or beyond nature. In other words, at this point we are saying the exact opposite of what Carl Sagan says in his Pop Credo when he says the cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be. We are saying the cosmos is not all that is or was or ever will be. God is. God exists. God's behind the cosmos. And as a matter of fact, it's only because there is a God that there is a cosmos. Because in a cosmos of cause and effect, you have to have a first cause behind it. Let me put it in philosophical language. If anything exists, there must be an inevitable, self-existent, uncaused first cause that stands behind it. Several years ago, in one of our theology conferences, John Gerstner was here, and he was speaking to us about creation, and in the context of his address, he recalled something that he had heard when he was a high school student in a physics class. His physics teacher had said on one occasion, the most profound question that anybody has ever asked is this, why is there something rather than nothing? Gerstner said when he heard that, he thought that was a most profound question, but as he grew older and began to sharpen his own thinking, he discovered that it wasn't a profound question at all. As a matter of fact, it's not even a true question. Because you see, the question, as it is stated, poses an alternative. Why is there something rather than nothing? But in order to be meaningful, you have to be able to define the terms, and you start with nothing, and you say, what is nothing? Define it. Nothing defies definition. It even defies conception, because if in your head you can think or imagine what nothing is. Nothing isn't nothing anymore. Nothing has become something because you're thinking about it. You see, if you can say nothing is, and then add on the other side of the sentence, so you're explaining what nothing isn't nothing anymore, has become something. Jonathan Edwards is not noted for being funny, and if you've ever read him, you know why that's an understatement. But on one occasion, he was almost humorous when he said, "Nothing is what the sleeping rocks dream of." Gerstner referred to that in his remarks, and he said, "So if anybody thinks he knows what nothing is, he must have those rocks in his head." Now you see, as soon as you ask, why is there something rather than nothing, and define the terms, nothing evaporates, and the only real question is, why is there something? And the only possible answer to that is Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which is what Christianity teaches. Now, I'm going to talk about the implications of God's existence for our thinking in just a moment, but before I do that, I have to add another doctrine to it. And that other doctrine is the doctrine of revelation. Because it's not just that God exists and that he's created the world, God has also revealed himself. He's made himself known. You remember the title of Francis Schaeffer's book years ago, back in the 70s, maybe about 78. It was about the third or the fourth one of Schaeffer's works that were published. It had this title, "He is there and he is not silent." Well, that's exactly it, you see. God exists, but he has not remained hidden. He has revealed himself, and he's revealed himself in a variety of ways. He's done it in nature, because nature testifies to his existence, and it tells us something about him. He's revealed himself in history, because he has intruded himself into human history. And we learn something about him there, but chiefly what we learn about is the scriptures. That's where he teaches us about himself. Now, a little while ago, two Sundays ago, I was talking about four isms: secularism, humanism, relativism, and materialism. I've just said that the doctrine of God is the specific Christian answer to secularism, as well as to a number of other things as well. Revelation is the specific Christian answer to relativism. Because you see, if God is spoken and God is truthful, then what God speaks is truth, and that is truth absolutely. It's not truth to be compromised. And so we have a frame of reference from which we can move. This has always been the conviction of the church. Down through all its centuries, God has spoken. He's revealed himself to us in Scripture. It is only recently in church history, from the world, but unfortunately also from within the church, that that's been challenged. But it has been challenged with disastrous results. Because you see, if God has not spoken, and therefore we don't have a sure word from God, a word that can be trusted, then all words are equally valid, and Christianity is nothing more certain nor more compelling than any other merely human word or philosophy. Now notice this, if God has spoken, then there will always be a certain hardness about the Christian faith and Christianity. Now I do not mean by that that Christians should be hard, especially with other people. We're not to be hard with other people. We are to be the most gracious of people, sensitive and understanding. But I do mean that in terms of truth, there will always be a certain unyielding quality to our convictions if we really are operating as Christians and thinking in a Christian way. For one thing, we'll insist upon truth, and we won't bow to the notion, however much it's pushed upon us, that, well, as people say, that's just your opinion. Several years ago, I was flying to Chicago from the West Coast, and I was sitting next to a woman on the plane. I got into a conversation with her, and it turned to spiritual things. And I would say something about the Christian faith, and she would reply, "Well, that's just your opinion." I wasn't certain how to deal with that, but the Lord gave me a way of dealing with it that preserved both the hardness of Christian theology and at the same time enabled me to be nice. I said something to her like this. I said, "Well, you're right, that is my opinion, but that's really not the issue, is it? The important thing is it true?" Now, she didn't know what to say to that. She came out of the relativistic mold. She never faced that kind of question. She didn't have a response, so the conversation continued. And a little while after that, I said something, and she replied, "Well, that's just your opinion." And I said exactly the same thing in exactly the same words. I said, "Well, that's true. That is my opinion, but that's not really what matters, is it? The thing that matters is it true?" That exchange took place about 12 times during the course of that conversation, and toward the end of it, she was beginning to get it. She knew what was coming. I would say something, and she would say, "But that's just," and she'd start to smile, and at the end, she was actually laughing because I had made the point. When I got home, I sent her a copy of Mere Christianity. You see, that's the sort of thing we're up against and against which we must fight. Another thing the doctrine of revelation will mean for us is that we won't back down or compromise on moral issues. Now, you know how it is whenever you speak out against something that is wrong. You're accused of making a value judgment. course, that's about the worst thing you can do in our culture, make a value judgment. And if they don't say to you, as the woman said to me, being nice, well, that's just your opinion, they attack you personally. And what they say are things like this: you'd do exactly the same thing if you were in her position. Or they say, who do you think you are? Do you think you're better than he is? Now, we mustn't be intimidated by that line of attack. We don't have to be mean as we reply, but we ought to reply something like this. We have to say, look, please, I wasn't talking about what I would do in the situation. I'm a sinner. Christians believe that they're sinners. I might do exactly the same thing. I might do worse. I might have fallen sooner. But you say, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about what is right. And I think we have to talk about what is right, because unless we talk about what is right and agree on what is right, none of us are ever going to do any better than we're doing, and we do need to do better, don't we? Now, you see, that maintains the hardness and speaks directly to the moral issue. Listen, here are some of them. Cheating, because everybody does it. That's the only way to pass in the university, isn't it? Cheating. Promiscuity, well, because that's a modern way of life, and besides, it's nobody's business but your own. It doesn't hurt anybody. Of course, it does. Abortion, because it's legal. Divorce, because that seems the better option. Here's what Blamire says. What the secular mind is ill-equipped to grasp is that the Christian faith leaves Christians with no choice at all on many matters of this kind. Why? You see, because we are people under God's authority. God has spoken. That's what Revelation is all about. And God's authority is expressed for us in the Bible. Now, I said I would return to some implications of the doctrine of God, and I want to do that now. First of all, if there is a God, and if he has made us to have eternal fellowship with him, which is what the Bible teaches, and we confess, the chief end of man, to glorify God and to enjoy him forever, then we're going to look at failure, suffering, pain, and even death differently than non-Christians do. For the Christian, these can never be the greatest of all tragedies. Now, they're bad. The devil is an enemy. The Bible calls death an enemy. Sin wreaks havoc in the world, but you see, it's never an ultimate tragedy. If you're a Christian, these things are overbalanced by eternal matters. Or let's look at it the other way. Success and pleasure will not be the greatest of all goods for us. We're not going to live just to be successful or to enjoy ourselves. Success and pleasure are good, but they don't compare with knowing God and spending an eternity with him. Here's the way Jesus put it. Jesus said, what good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his soul? And that's what people want today. They want to gain the whole world. They don't care about their souls. Or he said it on the other side. He said, don't be afraid of those who kill the body, but who cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. He was talking about God. That you're afraid of men for what they might be able to do to you. You better fear God a lot more. Now that leads to a Christian response to materialism. It's another one of the isms I mentioned two studies ago. Let me say that there are two kinds of materialism. There is a doctrinaire or philosophical materialism, which is what is characterized by communism. There is no God. And there is also a practical materialism, which is far more characteristic of the West. We have kind of a false syllogism in our heads. It goes like this. We're not communists. The communists are materialists. Therefore, we are not materialists. Did you see that's a false syllogism? It doesn't hold up at all when you think in terms of our very practical materialism. Our materialism warps our souls, stunts our spiritual growth, and greatly hinders the expansion of the gospel in our age. Now, the best critique of our Western materialism that I know of comes from the East, comes from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He was something of an American hero. He was imprisoned in the infamous Gulag prison system of the Soviet Union. He was released. He defected to the West. And when he came to the West, settling in New England, suddenly he epitomized everything that we thought was good, because he stood out against this terrible, evil menace of communism that we were all afraid of. He was invited, when he first came to this country, to deliver a graduation address at Harvard University in 1978. Now, as I said, up to this point, he was a hero. But in this address, he was so blunt in his criticism of the West that instantly he fell from grace. Nobody talked about Solzhenitsyn anymore. He just disappeared from sight. Everybody ignored him because nobody wanted to hear what Solzhenitsyn had to say. You say, well, was he praising communism? Why, of course not. He wasn't praising communism or socialism. He said, look, socialism is not only zero, it's less than zero. I'm not commending it, but listen. Should someone ask me whether I would indicate the West, such as it is today, as a model to my country, frankly, I would have to answer negatively. Through intense suffering, our own country has now achieved a spiritual development of such intensity that the Western system, in its present state of spiritual exhaustion, does not look attractive. After suffering decades of violence and oppression, the human soul longs for things higher, warmer, and purer than those offered by today's mass living habits introduced by the revolting invasion of our privacy by TV stupor and by intolerable music. What he was telling us is that the West has pursued physical well-being, our health fads, and the acquisition of things, our materialism, to the exclusion of almost everything that is spiritual. In 1989, people in the West were astounded by the rapid political changes that took place in the Soviet bloc countries. Country after country repudiated their communist heritage of the last 70 or so years, rejected their leaders, moved in the direction of democracy, and elected new leaders. We applauded all of that, and rightly so. But listen, we have to remember two things. First of all, while these former communist lands have moved in a more democratic direction, we, for our part, have moved more in the direction of their materialism, living as if the only thing that matters in life is how many earthly goods we can acquire right now. Remember those moving scenes of the destruction of the Berlin Wall as panel after panel collapsed and people who had been imprisoned behind it in East Germany streamed through the wall in order to see what life was like in West Berlin? Remember the pictures of them going into the supermarkets and seeing all of the variety of goods upon the shelves? Oh, boy, that was great television. You see, that's what television is so good at. It's a commendation itself for the value of the Western world. But listen, I ask the question, what's the value of them streaming across the border to look at all of the things we have on our shelves if all they discover here is a spiritual climate that is vastly inferior to their own? What does it profit a man if he gain all the varieties of detergent in the world and lose his soul? And that's the second thing we need to remember. Although the American media, with its blindness to things spiritual, will not tell us this, the changes that took place in Eastern Europe did not come about because of the will of one man, Mikhail Gorbachev, or anybody else, but because of the spiritual hunger and vitality of the people in Poland. The strength was in the Polish Solidarity Movement, and at its base was the spiritual vitality of the Roman Catholic Church in East Germany. Spiritual strength also lay behind the changes there. Conventional wisdom has it that the changes began on October 9th in that year when about 70,000 demonstrators marched in Leipzig. Now, normally in East Germany, what would have happened is this. It had happened before. The army would be called out, and it would fire on the demonstrators and disperse the crowd. This time, the protesters rallied, and their cry was this: let them shoot, we will still march. And the army didn't attack, and after that, the protest grew until the government was overthrown. In Romania, President Nicolae Ceaușescu, just weeks before this, had said that apple trees would bear pears before socialism would be endangered in Romania. The end began in the house of a Protestant pastor whose parishioners surrounded him, declaring that they were willing to die rather than let him be arrested by the state police. Joseph Todd, the founder and president of the Romanian Missionary Society, visited in Romania just after the death of Ceaușescu, and he reported the details of the story. This pastor was from a city called Timișoara, and his name was Laszlo Tokes. The day was Saturday, December 16th, 1989, just a few days before Christmas. First, a handful of his parishioners gathered, and then more, finally hundreds of people, and eventually thousands of people collected in the square around this church and the pastor's home. It was a young Baptist church worker there who was 24 years old. He got this idea. He said, what we ought to do is make this a different kind of demonstration. So he went into all the shops roundabout and he collected candles. And he passed the candles out in the crowd, and then he lit his candle, and then everybody lit their candles from him. And as a result of this, he transformed this protective strategy for the sake of the pastor into a contagious demonstration. And that was the beginning of the revolution. Well, the next day, the soldiers did open fire, and this young church worker was shot in the leg. Now, the medical care in Romania is primitive at best, and they weren't able to do anything about it. He lost his leg. They amputated his leg. His pastor went to visit him in the hospital, and the young man was not depressed. He was jubilant. He said this, a great testimony, "I lost a leg, but I am happy I lit the first light." See, the people in Romania, according to Joseph Ton, don't talk about that as a national revolution. They say, call it rather God's miracle. The rallying cry of the masses was this, God lives. We've seen demonstrations. They take place in this country. Can you imagine a demonstration like that where the people are shouting together, God lives, God lives, God lives. And that in a formerly atheistic communist country, the people shouted, freedom, freedom. We do not mind that we die. Willing to die. That's really it, isn't it? That is the bottom line and ultimately only valid test or whether we are practical materialists at heart or whether we believe in something greater and more important than things. I wonder if we do. I'm sure there are Westerners who believe that life is more than the accumulation of things, but not many. Back in the 60s, the blacks were willing to die for freedom, for values, and there were some whites who stood alongside of them. I think we've lost that. You know, in 1978, during President Jimmy Carter's abortive attempt to reinstate draft registration for the young, the newspapers carried a photograph of a Princeton University student who was waving a poster marked with the words, "Nothing is worth dying for." Chuck Colson refers to that in his book, Against the Night, asked the question, but if nothing is worth dying for, is anything worth living for? See, if there's nothing worth living or dying for, then what is the chief end of man? The chief end of man might as well be cruising the malls, which is what the polls tell us is the chief number one occupation of today's teenagers. Well, here's Solzhenitsyn. He summarizes our weak thinking at this point when he says of today's Americans, and I quote him exactly, "Every citizen has been granted the desired freedom and material goods in such quantity and of such quality as to guarantee, in theory at least, the achievement of happiness in the morally inferior sense which has come into being during these last decades. So, who now should renounce all this? Why? And for what cause should one risk one's precious life in defense of common values?" Christianity has the answer to that. And the Christians of the past have known it, and it is this, in order to obtain a better resurrection. It's what it says in Hebrews. And what that really means is, because doing what is right matters. To whom does it matter? It matters to God. And pleasing God, ultimately, is what matters. Who's going to live that way? Nobody, unless Christians, first of all, begin to think like Christians. Our Father, we thank you for this study, and we ask you to bless it to our hearts. And more specifically, we ask you to forgive us for living as the world, as if this world and its things, all of which will perish, are what really matter, and forgetting that we are creatures with immortal souls. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this message from the Bible Study Hour, a listener-supported ministry of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. The Alliance is a coalition of believers that hold to the historic creeds and confessions of the Reformed faith, and who proclaim biblical doctrine in order to foster a Reformed awakening in today's church. To learn more about the Alliance, select the appropriate link at thebiblestudyhour.org. Write to us at 600 Eden Road, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 17601. Your financial support makes our broadcasting, publishing, online, and event ministries possible. please consider making a gift at our websites by phone at 1-800-488-1888 or by mail. Canadian listeners can reach us at P.O. Box 24097, RPO Josephine, North Bay, Ontario, P1B0C7. Thank you for your prayers and gifts, and for listening to the Bible Study Hour, preparing you to think and act biblically.